LinuxQuestions.org presents LQ Radio, the number one online radio broadcast focusing on Linux and open source. And now, LQ Radio, open talk about open source.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 3 of LQ Radio. First, let me introduce the panel. It's the same panel as the last episode, episode number 2. And unfortunately, one of the members, John, is having some cell phone problems, so he's hopefully going to be joining us momentarily. So that leaves us with Finn and Dave. And one of the we got a ton of feedback after the previous show, and one of the things that came up consistently is we didn't give enough intro in the beginning so that people could key in on who is who. So obviously, I'm Jeremy. And Dave and Finn, why don't you just, say your name, and you don't have to give an intro or anything, just so people can tell who's who. So, Finn, you go first.
I'm Finnegan. I use Slackware pretty much on anything that will boot it. I mentioned that last time, so I'm into some hard repetition. I am very interested in the host names of everybody's machines. I think it's one of the most telling things about a person is what they name their boxes. Or crates. I'm also a fan of calling that. And I don't know. But what else?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
Dave.
Okay, on to this.
Nice segue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Dave, or I prefer David, but Dave will be fine. I go by my Cloud 9 on LQ, and I'm also a Slackware addict. Could be a shortcoming. I'm boiling to death in my office. How's that?
That works.
Yeah, me too. All right. As I said, we did get a ton of feedback after the last show, quite a bit more, I think, than we did after the first show, which is good. And we got quite a bit more downloads, too. And it actually was almost all positive. And the one thing that was very consistent is that the audio was very much improved over the first show. And I'm glad that that shows, because we did make a significant investment in the setup. And one question that continually came up was, what exactly are we running? So I'll detail that very quickly. I'm on a Shure SM7. It's a dynamic cardioid mic, pretty much a broadcast quality mic. That goes into a mic preamp that does noise gating, compression, enhancing, and de-essing. That's made by DBX. And this actually was recommended to me by Doug over at IT Conversations. So it's a pretty tried and tested piece of equipment for this kind of setup. From there, we go into a M-Audio mobile USB preamp. And that does all the mic input and the gaining and all that. And from there, that goes into the line-in on a Linux box, and we record from there. We are using Skype, but only the Skype Out facility. I'm dialed into Skype Out, and that's how I'm recording the show. David and Finn are both dialed in to a regular conference bridge over either a cell or landline. So that's the setup as of now. The next kind of upgrade would be to ditch Skype and move to either Asterisk or, if we can afford it, an ISDN line with a hybrid. So we could just, that's what broadcast studios use. So that would be the ideal setup.
We need sponsors.
Yeah. So if you're interested in sponsoring the show, that would be our first step. Good segue there, Dave. And that's pretty much the audio setup. Do keep the feedback coming. It was great to get that much feedback. If you want to email us, you can use lqradio@linuxquestions.org, and I'll make sure everyone gets that. Of course, feel free to post at the radio.linuxquestions.org site itself. Unlike most blogs, the setup at radio.linuxquestions actually is threaded, so it's not quite as hard to follow a conversation as it is at some blogs. That's a custom setup that David Ross added in there. So, like I said, keep the feedback coming.
More love to David Ross and Matt Scotsman. Another man we need to have on the show.
Oh yeah.
We are trying to put together a UK show that would basically be David Ross, Ray, who's Xavier P in the forums, and Chris, who's Acid Kupai, in the forums. And I haven't been able to pull it together yet, but I remain hopeful that that it'll happen. So
well,
stay tuned for
that. What about Unspawn? What about Unspawn?
Well, we were just talking about him. He's been MIA for a while.
Oh, really?
So this is a public call, a cry for help. Where is
Johnny? Please come back to us. the only moderator I don't know the real name of.
I think he likes it better that way.
I think I'm the only one.
Certainly. All
right. So
that's me constantly unplugging and plugging in power.
We'll move on to LQ news. The first one is just a quick note. We did add two new LQ profile fields to your user control panel, and that's the wiki username and the LQ bookmarks username. And basically, by filling those in, you can tie in all your contributions to the whole network of sites through one interface. So in all your posts, you'll be able to link to all those. So to access that, just click the user CP button at the top and fill those both in after, of course, signing up for both sites. And away you'll go. Next news story I have is, as I announced on the last show, LQ Bookmarks, which is at bookmarks.linuxquestions.org, is now live. We also got some pretty good feedback on that. I know the first couple days after it was live, we already had about 200 entries, so it's getting some pretty good traffic. And if you haven't used it yet, check it out and give us a feedback on that. And the last LQ story I have for now is LQ ISO we released a while back, and due to kind of a lack of resource issues, the updates had been a little bit slower than I would have liked them. And by updates, I mean, like as new distros come out, some of them wouldn't be added probably for up to maybe 10 days after they came out. And for the site to be really, I really like it to be pretty much the day it's released, you can download it from LQISO. So I'm happy to announce that three members have stepped up and are going to be manning the pending submissions queue. So if you use the site, please, if you see any distributions missing, make sure you click the suggest button, and they should get added now. I think all three of them are checking it every day. So I appreciate all three of their help, and that should make the site quite a bit more usable. And on the LQ ISO note, we're just about to hit 1 million downloads. Last time I looked, we were at about 970,000. So look for an announcement on that probably within the next month, I'd say.
Holy crap. Wow.
Yeah, the site grew pretty quick.
So who's doing this now?
The three members that stepped up were Massand, Dr. Oz, and Crashed Again.
Oh, okay, good. Crash.
It had been pretty much David Ross and myself kind of manning the queue. And with him doing the coding and me doing a lot of the admin stuff, sometimes it would sit kind of longer than we would have liked. But all three of them were glad to step up. And like I said, I really appreciate all three of them. Hopefully it should make a pretty big difference.
I actually have a success story for one of the much underloved sections of the LQ. I guess you could call them the massive side projects.
What's that?
The HCL. My roommate, Drunkish, the other day decided he didn't like the scanner we had because it was USB 1.1, and he wanted to scan, things that have DPI that made him 450 meg files. And, that took 6 minutes, so that annoyed him. So he looked for a USB 2.0 scanner, went straight to the Linux Questions HCL, found one that was 2.0 that was reportedly, worked bada-bing right out of the box, located it on eBay, bought it, and then, of course, asked me to pay for it because he was in a PayPal.
And it worked?
But, we don't know yet. It's, it's being shipped now. That was a story of 2 days ago. But, yeah.
Oh.
I mean, I'm pretty confident it will.
I see the site useful.
One of the biggest things about modding the HCL is getting to know that some of these weird little devices exist. One of the coolest I found was Rio makes a device that was a half-watt FM transmitter. And in and of itself, a 256 meg MP3 player, a compact flash. And iPods are all cool and all, but this thing was tiny. This was, a memory stick. You could clip it to your collar, that kind of thing. And it just, I don't know. Nobody gives anything but the Apple products love. And it bugs me because there's so many other cool toys out there.
And for those of you who don't know, Finn is the one who mods all the HCL entries. So when you add something, it goes into a pending queue, and then he goes through and makes sure it's not a duplicate and looks it over.
Usually what I do right before that is send Jeremy an email that says, I apologize, I haven't gotten to the queue lately. I'm stuck. Yeah, and it's kind of rough.
What you both glanced over is the fact that there's a pub in Scotland that must have kick-ass wireless in it. Access, because if Rossi can do all that,
that's true. Well, the HCL is also me going through and going, all right, one thing I've got to tell everybody who possibly listens to this and is going to go into their machine right now, and then, of course, turn around and enter stuff into the HCL, because you need to, because it's very important, because we're getting a lot of Google hits. I end up seeing stuff in Google that's actually in the approval queue and has yet to appear in the regular HCL yet. Anyway, remember LSPCI. It's your friend. It'll tell you all that anybody ever needs to know about the card. Put that in the HCL entry. It's me looking them up drives me insane. Card bus cards, AGP cards, those are just PCI cards. They appear under there, too. All right, I'm done with my ranting.
All right, well, we'll move into the news then.
Good.
I hate to do a SCO story. And I debated not doing it because I just...
No, you have to.
There's a lot of
news
this week.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I have tons.
But this one's got to be done. And, of course, the story is the recently unsealed email in the SCO versus IBM case where it appears that an outside consultant hired by SCO in 2002 failed to find copyright violations in the Linux kernel. And, of course, 2002 is roughly about when they hired McBride, I believe, and... about a day after this news story hit, SCO, of course, said that the email was inaccurate. I'm going to read a small snippet from the email for those of you who didn't see the story. This project was a result of SCO's executive management refusing to believe that it was possible for Linux and much of the GNU software to have come into existence without someone, somewhere, having copied pieces of proprietary Unix source code to which SCO owned the copyright. The hope was that we would find a quote-unquote smoking gun somewhere in the code that was being used by Red Hat and or other Linux companies that would give us some leverage. There was, at one stage, the idea that we would sell licenses to corporate customers who were using Linux as a kind of insurance policy in case it turned out that there was using code which infringed on our copyright. Please note, the scope of the project was limited to looking for evidence of copyright infringement. We didn't consider patents because SCO didn't own the rights to any patents, and more general IP issues were just too vague. Besides, SCO was sure that it was going to find evidence of copyright violations, which are comparatively straightforward to prove once you have found them. And then it goes on to say the person that worked on it, Bob, worked on the project for 4 to 6 months, during which time he looked at the Linux kernel itself and a large number of libraries and utilities, and comparing them with several different versions of AT&T Unix source code using automated tools that was designed to find and use fuzzy matching and ignore trivial differences and formatting and spelling. And at the end, we found absolutely nothing, no evidence of any copyright infringement whatsoever. End of email. So I think it was pretty clear to all of us, at least, that they didn't have a case even before this. But this hurts their position even more, and I think kind of brings up the question of whether there'll be some liability on their end for either frivolous lawsuit or something.
I'm hoping for like Bernie Ebers' level of liability. I'm hoping for like people who should serve some time for this.
I think they might
infringement.
It's kind of hard to prove a criminal level of negligence in this regard. Okay, now we're going to talk about SCO, huh?
You have to.
Okay, I've always wanted to play devil's advocate on this one. All that letter proves is that as of 2002, there was nothing. Let's navel gaze back to 2002. What were we in?
2.4.
2002 is barely 2.4.
Yeah.
So you don't have the new iOS scheduler, but that's pretty much Molnar, and that's pretty much from the ground up. Preemptible kernel, a lot of NUMA code that is part of the debate about what's going on.
A lot of that, yes.
that's one of the things that SCO claims is a ripoff, if I remember my news correctly. And
but
I can't quote anything. This is too much stuff. It's true. XFS didn't get introduced until,
That's SGI.
That's SGI,
I think you're thinking JFS.
SGI is a target of this whole mess as well. Because SGI has, you know, they have, you know, Irix is just another Unix variant, and they could just as easily try to pull their license as they did on AIX. And whether or not either of those has any, or whether or not the AIX license pull has any legal founding is still in flux. I mean, it's kind of, I don't know. It's a money and IP grab, and it's all become the biggest joke to us, but this thing could hang out there for a while and then come around to bite the open source community in the butt.
Oh, I think it'll go on
kind
for
of scary.
Months and months and months, maybe even a year still.
Oh, no, man. I'm thinking 2008 or 2009 before we hear anything distinctive.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure it'll go that long.
No, actually, we're already in 2007 for a court date, aren't we?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I thought it was January 2006.
Don't quote me on this one, but I think I was looking over the register articles today, and it said, like, Linux users will have to wait till 2007 for more news than the SCO trial. It was much more smarmier than that, because, you know, of course, it's a register headline. But, I think it's been long enough.
I don't think you'll see the kind of fallout that you did from Ebers, just because two separate reasons. He built, I think the final number was like $11 billion. And while McBride surely is a litigious bastard and clearly was fishing
litigious
here.
Bastard. Wow.
No,
there's nothing in the realm of $11 billion. And I think more importantly, Ebers got what he got, and it was kind of out of the realm of what he normally would have gotten. But the case appealed very much to the American mass media. And once they picked it up, they almost had to make an example out of him. And they picked it up because they could point to him and say he ruined the retirements of, you know, X thousands of blue-collar workers in this country. So every blue-collar worker in the country suddenly, you know, is thinking, what if that was my retirement plan? And that kind of snowballed. So they had to nail him to the cross, really. Most people still outside of the open source and maybe the tech community have never heard of SCO, have certainly never heard of Dale McBride, and know nothing about this case and can't identify with this case. You can't give me a 3-sentence summation of what this case is and have the average American care at all. And I think that's where the difference comes in.
I disagree wholeheartedly. Oh, my goodness. As far as the McBride thing goes, he was the guy mouthing off in the press about millions of lines of code, about deep diving, about you name it, and he was using that to pump the stock to, of course, to people in Baystar. And he was so incredibly wrong, and he could not have known. I mean, he could not have not known where he stood, based upon the Caldera ownership and the previous memo that you mentioned. There's no possible way. And if he didn't know, it's still criminal negligence.
Oh, this was definitely willful. I don't think anyone could dispute that. I mean, he did this knowing that.
What I'm saying is that you couldn't put that in front of a jury. You could take 5 minutes and send this up in front of a jury and say that, look, what this guy did was criminal. And it's no less than what Ebers did, or what's the Tyco guy? Anybody?
I can't think of it.
Tyco? Sorry.
Yeah. Nobody?
Drawing a blank here, man.
Yeah, same here. But it was
similar
willful
to the Regus in Adelphia, too.
Adelphia was bad, too. But, essentially,
but I still don't think you can get my dad to care about this one.
Well, your dad wouldn't care, but your dad would care if he was on the jury and had to listen to this trial. And when the IBM lawyers dropped this in your lap, you couldn't say, from what I've seen so far, that if there was any kind of plausible deniability.
Oh, it sure doesn't seem like it to me. I would agree.
No. And whether it's millions or billions, it's a scam. And they have to get spanked.
I think it was definitely a scam.
That's my opinion.
I think he should get jail time, personally, definitely. But I think because you won't see the mainstream attention, the prosecutors and judge will not be so incented to give, like Eber's got 25 years. I definitely can't see that happening in this case. I'd love to see him get a couple years, that's for sure. I think he deserves it. And I think an example should be set that you can't just sue for absolutely no reason. And,
well, the civil cases will far outweigh any criminal case. IBM has already countersued. Red Hat's sure to countersue.
Right.
Novell.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but like you guys said, it's not going to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
I think Slackware should have countersued just for the heck of it.
I think in the end, the thing that interests me the most about this, not this particular story, but the SEO IBM case in general, is that in the very beginning, I think it did a little bit of damage, and while probably not a lot of companies held off on migrations, a ton of them that probably would have put out press releases and made it a big deal kept it really quiet so they didn't become a target. So in the short term, I think it probably did have an impact on the negative side. I think in the long term, it probably helped on a couple different levels, Linux. A, I think that's going to win. They're going to come out on top. And by doing that, will be perceived to be stronger than they were beforehand. But even more importantly, a ton of news outlets that would have never been doing press of any kind on Linux now did. So I think there was an appeal to an audience that we wouldn't have reached for many more years from now, which I think is a good thing.
And, also the other critical, one of the things I can think of is many IT departments just being concerned about running critical infrastructure on free software when the legality of it was somewhat in flux to them. You know, IT managers that really don't get open source at all, and we're sweating this kind of thing, and then all of a sudden here comes the just gigantic legal test, and it turned into a joke.
Right. Oh, I got to call bullshit on that one. Can I say that on the air?
You can. You just did, so I...
No, because...
I don't edit the show, so...
The most recent release of SCO, what do they call their crap now? The
Unixware stuff?
Unixware, or... Sorry?
Yeah, Unixware.
Is it Unixware?
Yeah,
that's what they sell as. Unixware is based... I mean, there is a functional kernel of some type that is their proprietary OS. But everything else around it, from Apache to Samba, everything else is based on open source software.
And they really touted Samba 3 as one of the key features.
Oh, yeah, it was huge. It was huge. That and their ACLs and everything else. And yet, for them to raise the red flag or the red herring of open source is evil and bad and potentially exposes you to risk, when 90% of what they sell is essentially that.
Yeah, what I was talking about is more like old school Unix houses that, you know, never, ever, ever considered getting off of, say, Solaris until recently.
Oh, yeah, I understand, yeah.
All of a sudden, because Linux is, you know, there's nobody to yell at when it breaks, basically, is everybody's big
deal.
That
hasn't held true for a long, long time, though.
I know, but, you know, that's the popular myth.
I don't even think that's the perception anymore. I think that one's been cleared up by
Red Hat. Actually, it still is from what I've seen.
At least here, I've not seen that. Pretty much every, even clueless IT manager has heard of Red Hat these days.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's funny that
I don't know. I used to work at a university, and they are the last people to get it. It's, you know, civil service. A public university. They're civil service, so they're going to use something built beyond dead, and they're going to stick with something because, you know, they don't actually have to worry about a profit margin. So you end up with Solaris until the end of time. And I don't know, when they're eventually thinking about switching to Linux, or some systems to Linux, is right during the middle of the SCO debacle, and they're actually entered into the discussion. I got to be there to cackle a little, but I didn't have any decision-making ability, so all I got to do is laugh.
And you won't get any hate mail over that, I guarantee.
Yeah.
The other thing I kind of question on this one, and I'm not a lawyer, I don't play one on TV, and I have no idea what the actual answer to this, but since Caldera and then later SCO released a version of Linux under the GPL, wouldn't by them releasing it make it okay to be under the GPL?
Well, that was one of the earlier arguments in this case.
And it got shot down?
Well, one that's still avoided. I mean, they completely avoided that. And then they went from, it's not a copyright case, to it's a contract case. It's about NUMA, it's about AIX on power, it's about everything else but a copyright case. But yet, in the press, they tried to show it as a pure copyright case. There was people copying millions of lines of code. There was Gregory Blepp's briefcase in Germany full of copyrighted code. That was all evidence. There was the Las Vegas conference that showed obfuscated code. It went on and on and on. But yet in the court, even Judge Wells said that the phrase escapes me, but the judge said that essentially there was a stark lack of evidence for any infringement that it should have been shown by now.
I mean, they're trying to prove the license is invalid, so if they're licensing it under a license that is invalid, they can then turn around and sue themselves for fault, but in some way, shape, or form. But, it's kind of like IBM suing themselves for violating their own EULA on something, I don't know, on WebSphere. Isn't that right? Isn't that one of their products? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I never deal on the enterprise level.
Well, I'm sure we could waste the whole showtime debating this one, so we should probably...
Woo-hoo, it's over? Yes!
any of you guys have any last things to add to this one, or we'll move on to a more relevant and interesting topic?
I think we need to discuss what the critical threshold of SCO articles in the media is before we ever bring it up on a show again. I think it has to appear on one major news outlet, of which the Register would be the smallest marker of that, and it has to have at least like 5 headings on Elixir or on,
No, that doesn't count. That wouldn't happen either. Because going back to what I said in the last show, it wouldn't pass the dad test. My dad's never heard of SCO. He has no idea what's going on. He's heard of IBM, but as far as SCO goes, they're just like, who? What?
Exactly. I think we need to open this one up to feedback. I think the thread for this show, one of the things you as a user, listening to me right now, I'm talking to you in the second person, you as a user should post is whether or not you care about the SCO trial and what it would take for us to have to talk about it again. Because personally, I don't want to do it.
I look forward to not talking about this again until it's over. That's the next time I think we should talk about it. When we can finally say this is behind us and it's all over, I think we should have a whole show about it. But until then,
let's go wrap up party.
There you go.
Yeah.
And Dave can be really good and drunk for this one.
As opposed to what?
I don't know, man.
All right. Moving on. So the next story I have is actually... really old now. I had it marked down for the last show, but we kind of ran out of time, and it was old then, so it's only gotten older, but I think it's an important one, so I'll just kind of brush over this one. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but it's the Grokster decision. And basically, it came down that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyright, as shown by a clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement, is liable for the resulting acts of infringement by third parties. So basically, I think the problem here is going to be that, I'm going to use litigious bastard again, they're going to do everything in their power to kind of say that some very legitimate apps, such as BitTorrent, are being promoted to do piracy, not just are capable. So I'm glad that the distinction was made that the capability isn't enough, which I kind of thought it might go that way, that what the RIAA and the MPAA are able to pull off sometimes just absolutely shocks me. Did you guys have any thoughts on this one?
Sorry, John. Hit you here first, man.
No, go ahead.
Finn, go ahead.
All right. The way I see it is this just that language is rather muddled, and it's going to come up to the first legal test. It's kind of like a RIAA suing end users for copyright infringement. Has there been one that has actually gone all the way to an actual court date?
No.
Or did they just threaten people with a huge bill, threaten to settle out for virtually nothing, and on top of settling out for virtually nothing, they get to also claim, hey, we got this guy.
Yes, a victory.
You can claim a victory even though it never got anywhere near a courtroom. Anywhere near a courtroom. I mean, I don't know how many people have been sued and have even bothered to retain a lawyer yet, but it's probably a fraction of those people that have, you know, had the first piece of paper dropped off on their door, subpoenaed, as it were. And this one, I don't think I'll ever get a solid legal test because it doesn't really mean much. I mean, BitTorrent
means a lot.
I think BitTorrent would win in a heartbeat.
I think they wouldn't. Unfortunately for Bram, and I didn't know this. I kind of blogged about this one right after it happened, and someone had emailed me a link. He did, on his blog, promote piracy by using BitTorrent in very clear language.
He did.
So
he did, but however, I think the people that promote BitTorrent, now here's me being an absolute horrible neophyte. I just assumed BitTorrent was the best way to distribute free software. I had no idea people were actually using it to download music and movies and anything else. I am that naive. My name is Dave, and I had no idea.
But well, I'm the guy in your world, man.
Why? Well, it's rainbow colored full of lollipops. But on the Grokster thing, you know, when the guy goes on 60 Minutes and proclaims that it's the end of Hollywood and the death of Hollywood. I mean, they were pretty strong words.
Oh, I didn't see that. Who said that?
The Grokster guy, the giant guy. I don't know his name now, but there was some pretty strong. There was not just this is about file sharing. This is about it was about copying more or less. And he basically said that you can't. Yes, we are nothing more than an enabling technology, but by the way, you can download the greatest movie yet. And I think that really sunk him. And I think that's where BitTorrent will yep. So Bram had some pretty, let's call it off-color things to say about it. But
I still can't see that Bram writing software and then saying, yeah, I think it should be used for piracy should. Personally, I don't think that should make him liable. He's still not committing a crime. He didn't download anything.
Well, you and I say that that's logical, but what the courts say as far as copyright goes, and who has the highest paid lawyers.
Yeah. I think another problem that's going to come out of this is that companies, especially large ones, always err on the side of caution, you know, when it comes to any kind of potential litigation. So I think this case will almost definitely have a negative impact on innovation because some cool things that we might have seen, I think if it comes from a large company, they're going to say, well, this might be used for piracy and we don't even want to go down that road, so we're not even going to pursue the idea or release the software or whatever. And I think anytime innovation is impacted negatively, it's just a real shame.
Well, I agree.
And I guess the last comment on this one I have is that Mark Cuban pointed out on his blog that the Wall Street reaction to this was literally nil. So I think that's a pretty good indicator that the whole industry agrees that file sharing is not in any way negatively impacting Hollywood or the music industry. I think what's negatively impacting Hollywood right now is that almost every movie I see come out sucks. And people don't want to see them because they suck. So if they started making better movies...
Right now? We're at Batman Returns. We're at the Fantastic Four. Have we seen an original movie that has challenged us? No.
The movie quality is definitely going way down. Way down.
Oh, awful.
So they can blame it on file sharing, but people would still go to movies and rent movies if there were good movies to rent and to go see. I think the last time I went into Blockbuster, like a year ago, I ended up leaving and not even getting anything because I figured there's at least something as good on TV as there was there.
Right.
So start making good movies and stop complaining about file sharing is what I say.
Yeah.
Any other comments on this one? If not, I can move on.
Well, speaking of somebody that actually, you know, goes to Blockbuster to satiate their thirst between Netflix and Netflix, of course, I've maxed out to the 40-disc plan. I'm kidding. I'm still in the week 3 one, but I'm definitely going to move that up. No, man, there's plenty of good stuff coming out of Hollywood. It's just not what's
coming out.
It's a weak summer year, and because Star Wars came out. Nobody's going to put up anything good against the Star Wars. That's Preston. Where all the money went away.
Preston, come on.
Yeah.
What? What's the thing?
Okay. Hollywood's always put out crap, man. Come on. It's been a long time since we had a movie like Network.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So, anyway.
That was the 70s, right, so the 80s, 90s, 2000 to 2005.
I don't know. Terminator 2 was in there somewhere. Aliens was in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And then Alien 3 came out, and then, despite the fact that Fincher directed it, that kind of sucked. And then Alien 4 came out, and that was really horrible, even though Joss Whedon wrote it. I don't understand that. I watch a lot of movies, man. It's not that bad. It's just that
here's
bad
another,
normal theater.
Here's another appeal to the appeal to the listener. What do you guys
it's
think?
It's bad writing. It's bad concept, bad precepts, bad... let's make a movie about a sitcom from the 70s.
Hey, man, look, the last Batman was a heck of a lot better than the Joel Schumacher, you know, nipples on the Batsuit Batman.
Well, the only Batman that counted was the first one.
I actually kind of enjoyed the
second
one. It
didn't need to be
before.
A Batman,
it was a popcorn flick, but it was, yeah.
No, the first Batman was good because it was way out there. After that, it was sort of a waste of time. It was Batman 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's, we're getting into Rocky here.
Which is always a bad sign. So, all right. Well,
now we're arguing
we'll
about the status of Hollywood, and that came out of the Grotch decision, Jeremy.
We're
going to move on. Topic monkeys.
Yeah. So, like
you're
I said,
back
this
into
is
the
an,
wind.
Yeah, we're going. This is an appeal to the reader. We want to know what you think. Is Hollywood impacted because movies suck or because of BitTorrent? And post that on the radio.linuxquestions.org site. Next door.
Obviously, our listeners know that movies suck, so.
The next story that I had is the last two stories I have are somewhat tied together. The first one is the announcement of the launch of the Ubuntu Foundation. They got $10 million from Shuttleworth, and they basically set up the Ubuntu Foundation, and they're going to employ some core Ubuntu community members and key developers to ensure that Ubuntu will remain fully supported for an extended period of time. And I believe the press release said on the order of 5 years. And the first step they're going to take was going to be to release the next version sometime in April. And that will be supported for 3 years on the desktop, it was, and 5 years only on the server. And then, what is it, Canonical will continue doing the commercial support. What'd you guys think of this one?
I love it. I actually got my first Ubuntu about a month ago, and it's not Slackware. It's gosh darn, it's not what I'm used to. But new shoes always hurt, and the more I used it, the more I liked it. And it would be the one that I would drop a brand new user in front of, because it is just that good. It's polished.
I still keep meaning to install it and haven't. I really got it one of these days.
I refuse to drink the Kool-Aid. But, hey, I refused to drink the Gen 2 Kool-Aid for a long time. I ran out my laptop for like 8. I know, but, you know, when Gen 2 was the new big thing, when it entered the scene, and everybody was doing it. And, you know, we were talking about it like it was a cult, and like you know, like Gen 2 users were handing out pamphlets, and all of a sudden, AcidQP was the first of the moderator crowd that was just became an overnight convert. And I avoided it for a year, and then I installed it on something and played with it, and it really did. It breathed a lot of life into my old Pentium 3500 laptop. It really did. I dug it, and then I was on it for about a year, and then I was like, screw this, I'll go back to Slackware. Just
right.
Because eventually you find a niche and stick with it. Because I went through my complete distro slut phase about 3 years ago where I installed something on everything, so no two boxes matched in any way, shape, or form. And I was fine with it, and, you know, I diddled around until I got to what I enjoyed, Slackware. And my experience with Ubuntu is a whopping 2 hours where I fought with it trying to get X configured for a coworker. And I did, and we played with it for a while, and I was like, all right, it's another one. You know? I don't know what life's about.
I agree.
I definitely did not get to play with it long enough to make an informed decision. So I'm going to totally abdicate any... I'm backing away from that one. Actually, I apologize for anything negative I've said about the distro up till now. The one thing I'm interested in is whether or not it's going to actually basically become one of the... I've always talked about them as, like, you know, the Big Five or the Big Six. Debian, Slackware, now Fedora, SUSE, now Mandriva, Gentoo. Is Ubuntu going to enter into that list?
I think Debian-based distros are more the issue than just Ubuntu.
Sorry?
Yeah. Go ahead, Jared.
I think I tend to lump Debian-based distros into kind of one big group. And in aggregate, mm-hmm. they're probably the number one installed distro. If you include everything from Nopix to, I think, Linspire's Debian and maybe even Zandros. Or they might be Corel,
and
actually.
Nopix.
And so many
this one seems
really
to have a lot more
distros.
Steam than the others.
Well, they have Shuttleworth pumping $10 million at a time into them. Of course they have more steam. They have a bigger engine.
Okay. Okay, I have to stop this right now. The hemorrhaging is killing me. as far as Gentoo goes, the people that really pump and push Gentoo are the stage one build guys who are like hardcore, you know, like the hair on fire and the works. They are going to make it go. And the small percentage, I'm going to go where I went last week, of people who would have also tried to get the Mac OS X to run it on their Intel box, they're just, you can't stop them. So all the Gentoo guys, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, they all love their stage one builds, and they're all happy with, you know, they can run on a Pentium 2 through 33, and, you know, I'm all happy, and it's the way things were done when I was a kid. But as far as Ubuntu goes, you just can't compare that to Gentoo. Ubuntu is basically throw in a disk and make it go.
Well, they're certainly targeting way different
markets. Far simpler install than any Windows disk I've ever played with.
I don't think a Windows install is all that easy.
Really?
For you it is, or for me. But, you know, like this kind of came up when we discussed the conversation I had with Aza at GnomeDex, and then he posted it on his blog, actually, and that got slash-dotted. I think if I gave my dad a Windows CD and a computer with no OS on there, it would remain a computer with no OS on there.
I guarantee it. I fully guarantee it.
I'm not sure where the Windows installs are that easy come from. I think probably 80 or 90% of all Windows users
never installed it. They're nasty, hard, and evil. And then when something goes wrong, you're screwed. You are screwed, blued, and tattooed.
Yeah.
There's no...
I mean, not that I've installed Windows
no middle
in a long
time, but... As far as installs go, most folks I've known who've actually grabbed a SUSE disk can actually get stuff installed. And I'd have to say the same for the Ubuntu. It was so easy, and everything just worked.
Does it use Anaconda?
It was a flashy, sexy desktop with all the applications. Let's face it, after 4 or 5 reboots... In Windows, what do you get? You got Windows, you got a text editor, and a screensaver.
Well, these days you have a browser, you have a mail program, you have a multimedia program. You have everything that, as Asa used, and he loved to use the little phrase regular user wanted. And he did a really good job of describing what a regular user was. And that's it. I don't know, man. My dad, who, you know, not technical at all, retired, civil servant, not a job involving anything in technology, reinstalled, as he put it, you know, definite article, the Windows about 2 months ago because, of course, his previous install ate itself alive on spyware. And, you know, that happens. And you just back up everything to a USB hard drive because the Windows makes that dreadfully easy, and reinstalled the Windows and was fine.
Wow.
I mean, went from no loss to an entirely new one. No problems. Not
oh,
the
boy.
And definitely falls in the ASUS category of regular user.
I see. We got a whole show right here because my,
I was gonna
my
say, that's
category
what
of regular
bad.
User is people that confuse Microsoft Office. They say, well, what are you running? Well, I'm running Microsoft Office 98. What? Well, I'm running Microsoft Office 98. Well, what's your OS? Well, I don't know. I just running Microsoft Office something. They can't differentiate between the applications that they use every day and the OS that they need to run those applications.
I think that's slightly below regular user.
What's that?
I think that's slightly below regular user.
No,
I don't.
That's a regular user.
It's not what I see. I mean,
I don't know.
Maybe my friends are old and, you know, have cataracts and stuff, but...
There's still people, like, just on the phone that I would say, you know, start Internet Explorer, and they literally don't know what it is. If you say web browser or that spinning E, they'll click it.
Well, that's
but
the
if you
internet.
Say IE
that
or Internet Explorer,
the,
they have
with
no
my
idea what you're talking about.
That is the Internet. That's how you get on the Internet. They have no idea. There's a differentiation between how you get on the Internet. As far as they're concerned, they just see that they double-click the blue E, and then that's the Internet. That's their whole exposure to it.
Yeah. And I think the fact that Windows doesn't come with an Office suite means that probably a high 80% of all users, it doesn't come with everything they need. Because, the,
well,
you know, Internet Explorer and email
Windows,
client.
What do you get?
Actually, speaking of which, and to slightly get off topic because I love doing that, I installed OpenOffice, like one of the 2.0 betas, for the first time since something in the 0.9s. Wow! It doesn't suck as much anymore. What happened?
Well, OpenOffice Org 2 is nice.
Yeah, it was really
like
sweet. Yeah, I rebuilt, I don't know, all sorts of stuff on it. Anyway.
Yeah, that's going to be a big step, I think, for Linux on the desktop, is OpenOffice.
The funny part is that I had to install it in order to read a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah,
it was just sad. I mean, I tried to pipe it through strings just to find out what it was about, and didn't cut it. Anyway.
So I think this is another conversation that could... probably go on for quite a while. So, do you guys
to,
have...
I can throw one last...
Yeah, I was
going
to say,
on,
final
and
comments.
Comment
I'll let you close up.
Please.
Go ahead, David.
When you finally install Windows, what do you get?
Web browser and email
reboots,
client. And,
you don't get much.
Well, certainly nothing that compares to a Linux install.
Right. Any distro that you download for free or pay for... You get an Office suite, a graphics suite, the media of your choice. And when you install Windows, you get 5 reboots and a bunch of patches and not much else.
I think, though, for the demographic that Ace is talking about, the only thing probably missing from a default Windows install is a Office. And they whack you a couple $100 for Office, so it's a pretty big thing to be missing. But I think generally people want to do word processing, check their mail, and browse the web. That's probably...
Yeah, well, in this day and age, you got to add in basically any computer worth its salt is going to come with a burner.
Yeah.
So if you're doing a default install, you need a burner program in some way, shape, or form, and that isn't on there by default. Is it? Yeah, Windows Media Player comes with one these days, doesn't it? Yeah. That's right. That's
oh,
in
and,
there.
And I guess an
yeah.
MP3 player would be another prerequisite.
Yeah.
It's very DRM-y.
Yeah.
It's very DRM-y, so it won't let you, you know, like, burn an ISO. You just can't, or at least not as far as I could find, which meant it was, you know, obfuscated past the point of regular user. And what's the other big thing I was thinking about? The DVD player. No? Windows Media? Will that play DVDs? Oh, God.
No.
Okay, cool.
Not myself. When you buy your DVD drive, you get DVD software.
this is something that smaller guys like me have to fight with all the time. I can buy cheap CDR/DVD readers with no software, but software is what allows them to play DVD movies. The software costs about $40.
Windows
and
Media Player won't play a DVD.
Sorry?
Evidently not.
Sorry?
Evidently
Windows
will not.
Media Player won't play a DVD?
No, you have to have the software to decode a DVD. It's something I see on with guys on boats. They want to buy a brand new PC with a DVD burner or a DVD reader / CD burner, and they don't understand that if they just buy the cheapest drive they can find, there's no software with it. But software, they can't burn or watch or a DVD. It's not going to happen.
I did not know that.
Yeah. See, the crazy stuff we don't know anymore.
Yeah, I know. We're quite out of touch.
Life on the low end, boys.
So anything else on either the blog post from ASA or the Ubuntu Foundation? If not, I'll move to the next story.
Oh, God, no.
I don't know. I kind of wonder if it's the ASA blog post, but...
Go.
Okay. I actually wanted to agree and disagree with ASA. And it was really, if anybody hasn't read ASA's blog post, please go to it. It's a really well-informed one about why Linux is not ready for the desktop. And I have to agree with him. After reading this, he has persuaded me in many ways to believe that it's not ready for the desktop.
Well, neither is Windows.
Okay, neither is Windows, but, you know, hey. Anyway, it's on weblogs.mozillazine.org/ASA, and then it's one of the first couple links. I'm not going to rattle off the rest of the URL. These, that just gets nutty. Or if you just want to go to weblogs.mozillazine.org, it's one of the first links on there. It's ASA's blog. And I've
known
Casper
ever,
even though I haven't seen him in years, really. And he pretty much goes and tackles it on 4 points. And it's oddly enough, the second comment in the blog summarizes those 4 points very quickly. Migration, stability, simplicity, and comfort. The big thing about what made Firefox such a raging winner in basically their new attack in the browser wars is that they had a way to migrate from IE in all ways, shapes, and forms. Import all the bookmarks, everything, all the insanity. And one of the things that he says that Linux needs in order to succeed in the desktop is a full migration path for everything, that it should have a one-to-one ratio of application to application so somebody could install Linux over their Windows install and migrate in all of their, not just their browser bookmarks, but like their Outlook settings or their Eudora settings if it has that, or all, you know, basically all the little tweaks and goofies that you add on to Windows. He wants you to be able to migrate to Linux. The insanity of that ever being possible, just from, you know, the hard geek standpoint, just, I don't see it ever occurring.
I don't think
it needs to.
And I agree. I don't think it needs to either, which I'll get to later, because that's the one point out of his four that I disagree on. The other three, he's got us dead to rights. Stability, he's not talking about stability of Linux kernel because, you know, hey, we're talking pretty rock solid here. I haven't seen a panic in a while. It's usually when I'm doing something insane and I'm trying to bring one about. And he's talking about how basically APIs, libraries change so radically and so often that application installs are just a headache because things are missing. And that one has a lot of truth to it.
Yeah.
Hold on. Let me get to the list and then we'll bitch.
Okay.
Right. Simplicity, and in that one he's kind of talking about basically why do we have two desktops? That's the GNOME KDE split all over again. And then comfort, which is, as this guy summarizes, UI familiarity with current popular legacy OS. You know, or the way ASA put it is, why should a user have to learn what their, you know, the home directory is all about when they're used to My Documents? Actually,
why should they have to deal with the limitation of My Documents when something better exists?
Now, Ace is talking about a full migration path from Windows. Now, I see a lot of people migrate from, or from Windows to OS 10 to OS X, whatever your flavor of macOS is, without any hitches, and it's entirely different. But that's because they don't create this migration path. They just have a one-to-one application-to-application superiority, Mac mail rules, in comparison to Outlook. You know, what's the default browser? It's based on...
So you don't think, like, Thunderbird is better than Outlook?
Sorry?
You don't think Thunderbird is better than Outlook?
Actually, I don't know. I don't use Thunderbird. I use Silfeed. I like that.
I still use Pine, so I'm probably a bad person to ask, but...
Mm.
Every time I have to use Outlook, it enrages me.
Yeah, I haven't touched Outlook since like the last time it came with like a Windows 98 install, man. I mean, I know it's got a 5-10-year history with me for being the biggest virus vector on the planet next to rats. But that
right,
was a
so
bad metaphor.
Dave, you want to respond first, or you want me to?
I have to go here.
All right, go ahead.
Jeez, Kristen.
Where to begin?
That's a whole can of worms.
Yeah, it's a lot of can of worms there. I mean,
well,
I don't...
You know, we'll start with the mail thing. People just want to push a button, you get their mail, and reply to that mail, and that's it. Doesn't matter if it's Zinnian or if it's Outlook or, God forbid, the K-mail thing. They just want to do that.
Yeah. Well, the reason I see Ace's blog article and, you know, of course, the outrageous response it got, well, every Slapshot response is outrageous, is the fact that it's just a list of, here's what's wrong. It's not, how does the Linux world fix it? But...
Which is fine.
Because honestly, most of the way to fix it, if really these are the problems, and they kind of are, I mean, you can nitpick over whether or not you need a full migration path from Windows. You need to be able to, like, co-install Linux on top of Windows and then suction off all the preferences, blah, 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 blah. But the only way I can see if all these things getting fixed is if there actually does turn out to be one desktop Linux leader out of all
the
desktops.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God.
And then they get to choose all of the defaults, and then that becomes the way to do it. There is no clear way to do it.
Let me make a few comments here before
Dave's going to
explode.
Oh, I see that as the way that Linux will become, you know, the king of, you know, Joe Desktop. But I never wanted to be king of Joe Desktop. I like heterogeneity. It breeds strength.
No, you don't. You just profess to there must be one desktop to rule them all.
Hey, and that's about the only way I think it can be done. Is
oh,
if one
no.
distro really does.
Fine. Are you sure?
If we take everything that Ace had put down as granted, as what is wrong, the only way I can see that all getting fixed, unless every distro on the planet comes together and has a nice little happy conference in the woods where they all, you know, eat the exact same brown acid and agree on everything, you know.
But they don't have to
web
agree
standard
on
libraries for every single release to come out on. Bang, you know.
I don't think they have to agree on everything. That's why they have the LSB. So you develop against the LSB, and you know, any distro that conforms to that, the Linux standards base.
Yes.
So you conform to that, and then applications conform to that. But you don't all have to be drinking the same Kool-Aid. You can drink different Kool-Aids, just as long as the core is the same. I mean, I'm not going to get into everything I said because the show is just not long enough. If you go to jeremy.linuxquestions.org, I posted a pretty extensive post on this, and I'll sum that up here. And the first thing is, like I said, I had probably a 90-minute conversation with Ace about this at GnomeDex, and he makes some really, really good points. And the one thing I think we have to take a step back and not get defensive here is that Aza is not just someone bitching about open source or someone who doesn't get open source. He really gets open source. And not only that, he advocates open source for a living. So, I mean, this is a guy that's on our side and gets it for lack of a better explanation. So when someone like that, you know, talks, I think it's in our best interest to listen. And I think he makes some really good points, and I think some of his points I definitely don't agree with. And I think one mistake I think he makes is he draws too many parallels between a browser and an operating system. And what works for Firefox, some of it is definitely going to work for Linux, but some of it is definitely not going to work. They're just too different. One's an application, and one is not an application. And I think too many of the parallels he draws just are apples and oranges. So that's where I think some of the argument falls apart. The other thing I think is part of Windows' problem is they don't force any education on their users. And education is a little bit painful, and Linux does force you to know a little bit more about your computer. But there's a reason that, you know, whatever high percentage of Windows machines are zombies and spam-spewing zombies is because the users aren't educated, and through that ineducation, it causes no end of problems. So in this case, I don't think a little bit of education is a bad thing. I mean, they make you get a permit and take a driver's test before they give you a license because bad things happen if they just let you hop in. And I think forcing someone to learn a bit about their computer, that's not a bad thing.
Oh. Dave, are you okay, man?
That didn't sound good.
That didn't sound good at all.
No. See, we're not live yet, but the show is completely unedited, so you'll hear that. You still there, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay, there's too much suspense there, man. What do you do? This is the color commentary. Regain your breath, because apparently you just dug yourself out from under something large and metal.
He was so in shock by what you said that he fell out of his chair.
I sat in this box. It's an iMac box, and it wasn't that strong. So, anyhow, I fell in the box. Stop laughing. And then a computer on the bench kind of fell on me. And, well, shucks, golly, gee whiz. Everything's fine. No one
Everything
got
came
hurt.
Out okay? All right.
Okay.
So any last comments on this one?
No. Definitely next topic.
Although I think this might bring up a good LQ Radio interview, is we should get A's on here.
Yeah, no kidding.
For those of you who are going to read his blog post after this, as good as that post is, he articulates it much better in person. Yeah, he's a really smart guy that has a ton of good things to say, so I'd love to get him on the show. I'll have to email him. Now that I say that out loud, I remember I asked him to be on the show at GnomeDex, and he did say yeah. So he'll be one of the upcoming guests, so maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, the blog post, and what he thinks then. So you can look forward to that. So the last story that I had is the vendors team up on Debian-based Enterprise Linux. And the original story was sources close to Mandriva, Progeny, and Turbo Linux say the trio of companies will be announcing a new Enterprise Linux distribution based on Debian Linux at Linux World in San Francisco. And then the story kind of morphed into Mandriva is not in, and I think Turbo Linux is also not in. But Progeny is still going to be doing it, and they did sign on some other companies. And they're going to call it DCC, which is the Debian Core Consortium. They do say a lot of good things, and I think the Enterprise Linux landscape, if you will probably bear three distributions. I think that's definitely going to be the max. And, of course, there's already Red Hat with RHEL and SUSE Novell with SLES. So I think there probably is room for something like this. The problem that I see here is that these loosely coupled groups of Linux companies have not really worked out well. I mean, there was the Linux Core Consortium, there was United Linux, of course, and they just don't ever seem to work out well. This one's got some really smart people in it, and I think Ian's actually leading it up himself, who's the guy who started Debian and the guy who started Progeny. So they definitely have good leadership, but what do you guys think about a loosely coupled group like this?
Third time's charm? it would actually, I don't know. I think Debian's always been the unsung hero of the server room. I mean, when most people think about enterprise Linux, they don't realize that there is quite a bit. I mean, I work for a company, we run like nearly 1,000 boxes on Debian. But how much press is that really going to, you know what I mean? Because we haven't bought it.
They're more so going to target the enterprise space, not the hosting space, which is most hosting companies aren't going to pay, you know, the low-end enterprise products all tend to be above $300. I think SUSE is a little bit cheaper at maybe like $249. They're not going to pay that per box. It's just not – web hosting margins don't allow them to do that. But in the enterprise space, $350 is, you know, is pennies. And I think there definitely is a market for a enterprise-level supported version of Debian. And the one smart move I think they made here is they're going to use what's called Smart PM, which natively handles both RPMs and Debs. So you'll be able to pull from a huge repository of applications. And if you're like an ISV, you only have to provide, say, an RPM, and you'll be able to run on all three of the enterprise theoretical three enterprise products. So I think by doing that, they've positioned themselves to succeed. And they're two, or actually, I guess they have three big selling points with SmartPM. It's going to have a nice web-based front end for service management, similar to RHN, I would assume, which Debian, of course, lacks. And then it's going to have a guaranteed support cycle. So if they do all three of those, and the key is going to be for them is signing on ISVs. You know, if they can get Oracle to have this be a supported product, I think it'll succeed. If they can't get the Oracles of the world to have it be a supported project, then it will probably go the way of United Linux, at least from my point of view. Although I can say I'd love to see them succeed.
I mean, I'd love to see it do so, but it's another one's time will tell.
Definitely. And it'll be interesting to see who ends up joining. I was really shocked to see.
And it's really based around who ends up joining. I mean, why would Mandriva back out? They're on life support, you know.
But why would Mandriva join was my question. I mean, they have a distro, and it's not
really?
Anything. I mean, that might have came out the wrong way, but their distro is kind of polar opposite of Debian. So for them to completely ditch a product they've put 10 years in and go with Debian seemed like a really odd move to me.
Well, it's not 10. I mean, remember, Mandrake originally was, like, the youngest for a while there. It was, like, 98 is when they came on the scene. Am I right?
Oh, okay, you're right, sorry. So, like, 7.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
But,
wow,
I mean,
that is 7.
To throw that many years away...
Yeah, it's true.
It just seems like something that would kind of alienate their existing user base. So,
okay, well, I hope to call kind of bullshit here. Now that we're talking about Debian, is Ubuntu just like Ubuntu is Debian based? So why is that not why is that not the accepted base for a desktop?
I don't follow Ubuntu closely enough to know. I know there were some issues between Debian developers and Ubuntu developers a while back. I'm not sure if that even whatever happened with that. Because they use Sid or Sarge for the last version of Ubuntu.
Sorry?
Did they use Sid or Sarge?
Why isn't... I don't know, man. Debian offshoots... I once had this job a number of years ago, had an insane turnover. It's like people were going in and out of it about once every 2 weeks. So I had a standing rule, if they hadn't been around a month, I didn't bother to learn their names because I just have a hell of a time remembering somebody's name. I'm taking that long view with Linux distros these days. I'm I'm thinking I'll accept Ubuntu as existing in my world in about January.
Well, I think it's definitely here to stay.
That works for me.
It's not going anywhere.
I don't know. They're still in my Mayfly category for the time being. I mean, there's been a lot of them that, you know, have come and gone that have been really cool. I mean, I actually liked Caldera at the time I installed it, especially, you know, when I was done with the install, it gave me Solitaire to play with while it was actually playing RPMs. You know?
But that's been a lot that have come and gone. They just turned into
Sco. Huh?
That distro didn't necessarily go anywhere. They just turned into Sco.
Yeah.
No, it went nowhere.
Yeah. It kind of stopped at, what, 2.4? Open Desktop 2.4?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
It was the last solid release.
I actually bought that one with Chapters.
I don't think Ubuntu's going anywhere. I think they're here to stay.
Okay.
Oh, ouch.
I have to guess.
Come on.
You think they're going away?
No, yeah. You're agreeing with each other violently.
Oh, yeah, I said they are here to stay.
Jeremy is agreeing with you. He
it's
does
not
believe
away.
It's leaving.
Will not go away.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, that's what I said.
I don't really think it's going away either, but I'm just not going to bother to remember its name until January.
The other thing this kind of made me think of as we were talking about enterprise-supported Debian distros is, what happened to User Linux?
Who? Huh? Who?
The one that his parents put together? Exactly.
See, not only did I not bother to remember its name, I forgot it existed.
Did they even ever release it?
User Linux? Oh, wait a minute. That was the one where...
User mode.
No,
it was
an announcement. It was about a year and a half ago. Was that Ian Murdoch?
No.
No? The other guy?
Ian Murdoch started Debian.
Right.
Bruce Perens started
Perens.
User Linux.
Ah!
What, Bruce Perens?
Yeah, Bruce Perens added User Linux. It was going to base it around Debian and have it be a completely desktop-y kind of Linux. Basically, you know, like Progeny or Zimian, except that only, I guess, without cruft or more compatibility, you know, insert thing that would make it cooler here.
And, well, I don't think it was ever even released.
Yeah.
At least not that I saw.
Right, wow,
so anyways,
a vapor distro.
That's going to...
That's never happened before.
That wraps it up for my stories. David, I know you said you had maybe one or two, so we'll move on to you.
Actually, we should move on to Christian first.
Christian, we'll move on to you.
Well, Dave has a fist fight with what sounds like his kitchen.
Sure.
Okay. Dude, you can take it. You can just go a couple more rounds. All right. Unfortunately, we got around to ASA pretty quick. That was the one thing I wanted to cover because we mentioned him in the last show, and I actually then went out and read the web blog entry and got really stoked about it and actually thought about it while it worked because, you know, I got very little else to do. And then we, of course, covered that really quickly already. I don't know. I guess we could go into the things that I had left over from the last show, which unfortunately are kind of becoming ancient history, which means, you know, it was a month ago. Sun's acquisition of, and now I'm brain farting on the company. What was it? Jeremy? Help me out here.
Sun's
acquisition. The Filler's guys.
Yes, the gigantic tape company.
Yeah, the guys with the stuff. Yeah, those guys.
I actually missed this one.
Jeremy?
You with us there?
I have no idea what news story he's talking about.
Sun, huge... some insane acquisition. I want to say $2 billion of a storage company. You know, storage.
Well, Johnny,
right up there with buying a wheat company. You know, it's an incredible amount of money to spend on a market that's, you know, going nowhere.
Storage tech?
Yeah, storage. Thank you.
Yeah. God. Boom. Bam. Sorry about that. Holy crap. He's good.
Good old Google.
Yeah, exactly. The new Google. It's just, I don't know. It's basically what is going to happen with Sun over the next X years. It seems like they keep becoming more and more redundant.
That deal was actually $4.1 billion.
Really?
What? No, not that
much. The news story actually says, leaving many analysts scratching their heads, wondering exactly why the deal occurred.
Yeah.
This is at storage.itworld.com.
Well, I'm scratching my head wondering why Johnny Schwartz has a goddamn blog. Because, I mean, you know, the boy ain't wired up right.
For those of you that don't read his blog, he does on occasion say some interesting things. And I can't remember the link to it off the top of my head, but I'm trying to look it up now quick.
Okay, oh, so I have to fill in
it's,
the
blogs.sun.com/Jonathan if you want to check it out. All right, so Finn, what else do you have?
Aside from, you know, like, what's going to happen to Sun? I mean, it's like, I don't know. I love Sun hardware. I mean, I've got an Ultra 5, I've got an SS20. They're both running a BSD, but, you know, whatever, because Solaris runs pretty slow on them now. I've got another box that's running Solaris 9 x86 edition. And I like Sun's, I like Sun's hardware and software products. But why doesn't the world seem to anymore? Aside from, you know, the insanely high price tags they all come with.
I think they do really make some kick-ass hardware. I think a lot of people stopped liking Sun because of the attitude they had that they were so much better than everyone else that they didn't even have to pay attention. And they had that attitude for too long for their own good.
Huh.
At least that's how I've seen it. And Solaris was kind of slow on the uptake of some technology. They kind of stalled at 7 and 8. And they're trying to get back on track with 10, but I don't know if it's too late for them.
The other one I had is, similarly, is poor, sad, unfortunate SGI.
Aww.
This is a company that came up with some incredible innovations. These guys rocked. I don't know. I mean, they had one of the first fully Windows-like GUI Unix systems a long time ago. It's like 94. It's when they're putting out indies, you know, at like 10 grand a pop with this thing on there.
Right. You just love their file system. Admit it.
XFS. Oh, yeah, I mean, I've been an XFS, you know, bitch for 3 years now. I put it on everything.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that Riser really is becoming kind of superior these days.
Yeah,
I'm a Riser guy.
But, Jeremy and I have gotten into that one before. Anyway, I don't know. It's one thing to say about XFS, designed by default to be future-proof. I mean, the top-end size limit of a file. Am I talking to myself now?
You are.
XFS, by default, will deal with this file system size. I want to say it's like 9 exabytes.
Yeah, you know what? XFS has the best kernel oopses ever.
Nobody's put together a volume that large yet. I mean, has anybody gotten an exabyte logical disk yet?
No.
Not a part. And then partition that puppy. Yeah. See how long CF disk takes on that thing.
I can't point the finger at XFS, but all I have to say is that with XFS on my dual P3 rig, well, gosh darn. Doesn't it crash and oops sometimes?
It does?
Yeah, it does.
I had one really nasty repair job I had to do in XFS once, and it was actually on a failing drive. And it didn't do that great a job. But then again, it was on a failing drive. And I lost 200 megs worth of stuff across 60 gigs.
Well, there's only so much you can do with a failing drive.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the one time. I've only ever had to run XFS repair about 4 or 5 times between about 20, 30 machines. And we started using it at work on absurdly large volumes because our default file system is X3, and it just, you have a lot of file system overhead that you begin to lose out when you start dealing with a terabyte. And so we went to XFS for that, and I don't know, it works out brilliantly. Anyway.
I've seen more oopses they have the XFS in the oops report, but, chucks.
Well, dude, stop running 2.4.18. It was a nice kernel, but its day is past. I don't know. I mean, I've been running XFS since long before, when did they finally get in? I think it was like 2.4.24 when it was finally part of a regular kernel. Like, I had to go get my kernel source, and I had to go to SGI and grab my XFS patch and then apply that. And I really never had any problem. It's a brilliant patch.
I have to remember when you were so happy that you didn't have to patch anymore.
Yeah. I was stoked. It was like about a week after a solid kernel release come out with one, and it always bugged me because that was right during the festival of, there's root level entry hacks on Linux kernel. So it's like, you're going to run something that's not secure for a week. Oh, well. Oh, cool.
Like, so I didn't actually see the whole story on this
certainly,
one. I didn't actually see the whole story on this one. Are they pending going under, or what was the...
it's just the fact that, they're not selling as well, and they backed the absolute worst horse on the planet. They backed the Itanic. I'm using register terminology. But the primary processor that it decided to switch to was the Itanium. Yikes, Who's coding for Epic these days? Anybody? Bueller? So... Is SGI going to be able to pull itself out and become, a good, solid research company again that, puts out the big iron that everybody oohs and ahs and says that's really sexy? And, the stuff is purple.
Those origins are something else.
I've got an SGI dual P3 server. Okay, admittedly it was made by VA Linux, but it's cool. Even though it's not under warranty any longer. But, Yeah, and the origins were cool, and their MIPS architecture rocked for the longest time until they decided to dump it for Epic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so do you have another story?
No.
All right. We're already at almost an hour and a half anyways, so
JT didn't make it.
JT, unfortunately, did not make it.
Can I blame JT for my pretty poor performance?
You can.
Okay, yeah, it's JT's fault that Apple can't make a solid enough cardboard box for you to sit on.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, so with that being said, we should be much more consistent than we had been in the past. It's only a week between this show and the last show, and I would anticipate hopefully one every couple weeks. So on behalf of Finn and David, thanks for listening, and stay tuned.